next on Think, we'll speak in depth and one-on-one with each of the two candidates to represent Texas in the United States Senate. Incumbent Republican Ted Cruz.
I think most Texans want to see the border secure, want to see rule of law respected, and want to see us remain a country that welcomes and celebrates legal immigrants.
And Democratic challenger Beto O'Rourke.
I know that those Republican and independent voters, as well as those Democrats who I'm not going to take for granted, all need to be heard. I need to be out there listening to them and showing up and being in every single county.
Our wide-ranging conversations with the men who want your votes in November after this short break. From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It may be that the only people working as hard as the Democrats hoping to flip the balance of power in Congress are the Republicans who intend to hold on to their advantage. If primary turnout numbers are an indication, Republicans still have the upper hand in Texas. If Representative Beto O'Rourke managed to oust Republican incumbent Senator Ted Cruz, it would break a nearly quarter-century dry spell for Democrats looking to win a statewide election. It's shaping up to be a fascinating contest. But look, you can get endless analysis of the horse race elsewhere. So we decided to sit down with both candidates for in-depth conversations about the policies that matter most to them. Later in the hour, we'll hear from his Democratic challenger, Congressman Beto O'Rourke. But first, our conversation with Senator Ted Cruz, which we recorded in his office in the Russell Senate Office Building. Senator Cruz, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you.
So Senate Majority Leader McConnell wants to work through much of the traditional August recess to fast-track some confirmations to the judiciary. Is anything about that fast-tracking related to the urgency of the upcoming midterms?
Well, I think it's much more related to the urgency of continuing to deliver on our promises. I joined with 16 other senators in writing a letter to Mitch urging him to cancel the August recess. And the reason is, what we have now is really quite rare. In the last 100 years, we have had unified Republican control of the federal government, a Republican president, Republican majorities in both houses, only four times in 100 years. Only 8 years since World War II. And, you know, in the last year and a half, I think we've delivered a remarkable amount for Texans and for the American people. We've seen an historic tax cut that is producing jobs all across the state. We've seen regulatory reform that are lifting job-killing regulations and benefiting Texas farmers and ranchers and small businesses. We've seen the Obamacare individual mandate repealed. That's something I led the fight to do in the Senate. And we've also seen strong constitutionalist judges confirmed on the Supreme Court and federal courts across the country. That's a strong record of delivering on our promises, but we've got another 7 months in 2018. And so I join with 16 other senators in urging Mitch McConnell to cancel the August recess for us to stay and keep working, keep delivering results for Texans. I'm very glad he decided to do that.
You also want your colleagues to work Mondays and Fridays here in the Capitol.
Absolutely, and indeed I've urged we should work weekends. Part of this is because of the historic obstruction we're seeing from Senate Democrats. You know, our country right now is polarized. We're deeply divided. It's very unfortunate, the divides we see, but the extreme left is demanding of Senate Democrats fight, obstruct, resist. I mean, that's their mantra, resist. And what we're seeing is that the Democrats are filibustering essentially everything. They filibuster essentially every substantive piece of legislation. And just about every nominee, they delay, they burn 30 hours apiece. So we've got a massive backlog of federal judicial vacancies because the Democrats are demanding 30 hours for each one, which just slows it down. We have a massive backlog of confirmations into the administration. You know, it's really, I think, quite unfair both to the president and to the country not to allow the president's team to go into the agencies. It makes it impossible to deliver on policy commitments. And so that's one of the reasons why I and a number of other senators have been urging, if the Democrats are just going to use every procedural tool possible to delay and obstruct, we ought to stay here and we ought to keep working and keep working and keep working, because it's not an acceptable excuse to the people who elected us. Well, sorry, we couldn't deliver because the Democrats wouldn't let us.
President Trump has proposed a variety of ideas to enhance security along the U.S. border with Mexico. What evidence do you see that we need to do more to protect that border, since Texas takes up more than half of it?
Well, Texas, we have 1,200 miles of the 2,000-mile border, and for far too long, our border hasn't been secured. I've spent a lot of time along the border from El Paso all the way to Brownsville, and I think Texans, I think Americans are frustrated with why the federal government can't get serious about securing the borders. I think most Texans want to see the border secure, want to see rule of law respected, and want to see us remain a country that welcomes and celebrates legal immigrants, like my father was in 1957. He came from Cuba with nothing, came to America seeking the American dream. That's who we are as a people. I think that's entirely consistent with rule of law. And we have had a system for far too long that encourages illegal immigration, that has, for example, sanctuary cities where you have local Democratic politicians welcoming and encouraging illegal immigration, often people coming in with criminal records. That makes people unsafe. And so I think there's a lot of common sense legislation that Texans support that are being blocked right now in Washington, things like Kate's Law. I am the author and the original sponsor of Kate's Law in the Senate. Kate's Law provides that for an aggravated felon who repeatedly enters the country illegally, that felon faces a mandatory minimum prison sentence. It was named, as you know, for Kate Steinle, beautiful young woman in California who was murdered standing on a pier by an illegal alien who had been repeatedly deported. He'd been repeatedly convicted of felonies. He's gone in and out of jail over and over and over again. If Kate's Law had been on the books, that repeat felon would have been in federal prison, and Kate Steinle would still be alive. I think it is far past time for us to do everything necessary to secure the border. That includes a wall, that includes fences, that includes technology, but most critically, it includes boots on the ground. It includes, for a long time, I've called for tripling the border patrol so that we have the law enforcement and security to keep the border secure.
Let me ask you about the wall. That Quinnipiac poll this spring says 53% of Texans don't want it. A majority, larger majority of Texans who live along the border don't want a wall. Can we keep the border safe without one?
When I'm down on the border, every time I'm down on the border, I typically meet with law enforcement. I typically meet with border patrol agents. And I asked the line agents, a couple of months ago, the National Border Patrol Council, which is the union of the Border Patrol agents all along the border, they formally endorsed my campaign for reelection. And, they just about never get involved in campaigns. And their sector presidents, they all flew to McAllen to announce the endorsement. And the reason they said they did so and chose to do so is that because I've been fighting for the Border Patrol agents to be better able to do the job, to be better able to secure the border. So on the question of the wall, there's lots of debates and lots of people say, well, walls don't work. Well, listen, I ask the Border Patrol agents, I ask law enforcement, you tell me, do walls work? You're doing this every day. Consistently, the answer I get is yes, walls make a difference. Now, they're not a panacea. They don't solve everything. There's the old line that if you build a 15-foot wall, people will carry 16-foot ladders. And there's significant portions of the border that already have a wall, that already have fences. And what the agent said is where there are walls, you see people crossing the Rio Grande that will bring ladders. They'll bring them across the river and they'll run with them. But what is critical to stopping illegal immigration is the time between detection and apprehension. That when you monitor and detect someone crossing the border illegally, whether it's a narcotics trafficker or someone trafficking human beings, the time between when you spot them and when you can get Border Patrol agents to apprehend them, if they can blend into a population quickly, they disappear. What a wall does is it slows them down long enough that the Border Patrol agents have time to apprehend them. And so consistently, the answer I hear from law enforcement is yes, that is a very helpful tool in stopping illegal immigration.
When families are apprehended having crossed without legal authorization, is it appropriate to separate parents and children?
There's no doubt that illegal immigration causes human tragedies. And many of those tragedies are visited on kids. During the Obama administration, we saw an avalanche of unaccompanied minors, unaccompanied children coming into this country. And the reason they came, when they would get here, you'd ask, why are you coming? And they'd say, we're coming because we get a permiso. If we get here, we get to stay. But the consequence is that we had hundreds of thousands of little boys and little girls being brought in by, not by well-meaning social workers who are just trying to hug them and take care of them, but by vicious transnational criminal cartels. And these cartels, these traffickers, were physically abusing, and they are physically abusing these children. They're sexually abusing these children. Nobody who cares about humanity, nobody who cares about compassion, would want to see a system that encourages illegal immigration. Now, recently, the press has been focusing a great deal on the issue you specifically asked about separating children from parents. Well, I'll tell you, there's a reason why under the Obama administration that often didn't happen, because when they apprehended people here illegally, they just let them go. And when you let them go, you didn't separate children from parents. You know, you think about it, if someone gets arrested for a crime, let's say an American citizen gets arrested for a crime, for murder, for burglary, for whatever. If you're arrested from a crime, you're separated from your children. You're put in prison. If you're the only caregiver for that child, then you've got to find alternative care for those children. That is often another family member, or if need be, it's a foster family or some other means to care for kids. That is the inevitable consequence of somebody being arrested for a crime. This is an issue that I think the media has largely constructed, because what's shifted is that the Trump administration is endeavoring, when people cross illegally, to arrest them, not to let them go. And so if they have kids, you know, there's actually a court order that prevents keeping the kids with the parents when you put the parents in jail. So when you see reporters, when you say Democrats saying don't separate kids from their parents, what they're really saying is don't arrest illegal aliens.
You signed a letter urging the U.S. Trade Representative not to pursue a take-it-or-leave-it strategy on renegotiating NAFTA. President Trump reportedly is considering replacing NAFTA with separate trade deals with Mexico and Canada. Texas exports almost $100 billion a year to Mexico. Do you think the president is playing with fire here?
I hope not. The question you asked about trade is the most consistent concern I hear from the Texas business community. And my view on NAFTA renegotiation is that it could be a good thing or it could be a bad thing. NAFTA renegotiation would be a good thing if it's used to expand our access to the Mexican market, to the Canadian market, to increase international trade. That would benefit Texas, it'd benefit America. NAFTA renegotiation would be a bad thing if it's used to erect tariffs and barriers to our markets and to decrease trade. Yesterday, I spent about 2 hours at the White House with the president, a small group of senators, talking about trade, talking about NAFTA, and energetically making the case, as I have for the last year and a half, that we need to expand trade with Canada, with Mexico, and that Texas in particular. I think the greatest opportunity on NAFTA renegotiation is energy, opening up the Mexican energy markets. There are vast oil and gas resources in Mexico. They're not being adequately developed because of their political and legal constraints. What I've urged the president to do, you know, some months ago, the Mexican foreign minister actually sat in this office where we are today, sat on that couch, and said to me Mexico was very interested in codifying President Peña Nieto's liberalization that he put in place for the energy market, putting that into NAFTA, and even potentially taking it further. And what I urged the president yesterday on the negotiating team is that opening up those Mexican energy markets would produce thousands of high-paying jobs in Mexico. That's good for helping grow the Mexican middle class. But naturally, the place they'd turn for expertise to develop that oil and gas is Texas. It would produce thousands of high-paying jobs in Texas. That's a win-win. That's the sort of thing we ought to be pursuing. That being said, there are very much divided voices within the administration, and so I hope the voices advocating expanded trade prevail over the voices advocating restricting trade.
We're listening to my conversation with Senator Ted Cruz. Coming up, Cruz talks about his relationship with President Trump.
One of the more surprising things about where we are today is how good a relationship I have with President Trump. The reason is simple. The stakes are too high for it to be anything else.
And we'll hear from Cruz's Democratic challenger, Congressman Beto O'Rourke.
no state has more to gain or more to lose on the future of NAFTA than does Texas.
That's after a short break. From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Today we're talking with the two candidates vying to represent Texas in the U.S. Senate. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Democratic nominee Beto O'Rourke. But first, we'll continue with my conversation with Senator Ted Cruz, who I spoke with late last week in his office on Capitol Hill.
How would you characterize your relationship with the president today? Would you say he has changed the climate in Washington?
One of the more surprising things about where we are today is how good a relationship I have with President Trump.
That surprises many people.
You know, I think it's fair to say that 2 years ago, very few people would have predicted that. The reason is simple. The stakes are too high for it to be anything else.
Do you trust and like the president? Is he a friend?
I think it's fair to say the president and I are not going to be vacationing together anytime soon. But he was elected by the American people, and the policy decisions that the president and the administration have been making have been remarkably good. If you look, for example, at the tax bill, over 4 million Americans have already gotten pay raises or bonuses because of the tax bill. The excitement that I hear from Texas small business owners, you know, just this morning I was meeting with several Burger King franchisees in Texas, small business owners, and I love the restaurant business. You know, my dad when he came to America from Cuba in 1957, his first job was washing dishes, making 50 cents an hour. He couldn't speak English. The restaurant business helps millions of people get their first job, start climbing the economic ladder. And I asked, you know, these Burger King franchisees this morning, I said, how's business? They said, business is doing great. They said, the tax cut is benefiting us enormously. And under the Trump administration, the regulations that are killing us have been lifted.
Can you clear something up for me? You were delighted by the pardon that the president issued for Dinesh D'Souza. Did you ask him for that pardon?
Yes. Yeah, no, I had a conversation with the president. It was shortly after he had pardoned Scooter Libby. I felt that Scooter Libby's prosecution was political, it was unfair, and so I congratulated the president on pardoning Scooter Libby, and I told him another similar situation that was an unfair political prosecution was Dinesh D'Souza. The Obama administration targeted him and secured a criminal conviction, not because of what he did. What he did routinely is handled with a civil fine. Nobody else is criminally prosecuted, but because Dinesh D'Souza was an outspoken conservative movie maker, because he made a movie critical of Obama, the Obama administration, and what I thought was a real abuse of power, went after him and punished him for exercising his First Amendment rights. And so I urged the president, I said this was an unfair political prosecution. The president agreed. I'm very glad he made the right decision and exercised his constitutional authority there.
One area in which you've disagreed with the president is the fate of the International Space Station, which the president would like to fully privatize. You would like to keep it under the control of NASA. Maintenance, I think, runs $3.4 billion a year. So what do Americans get for keeping that a public commodity?
Well, you know, one sort of friendly amendment I'd offer to your question. I don't think this is actually an area I disagree with the president. This is an area I disagree with a low-level staffer at the Office of Management and Budget who managed to write a sentence into the president's budget that I'm quite certain the president has not focused on this policy issue at all. But this particular staffer, the idea that we would cut off federal funding for the International Space Station is a really bad idea. For a number of years now, I've chaired the Science and Space Subcommittee of the Senate Commerce Committee. And I am an energetic champion of space. There are tens of thousands of jobs in Texas that depend on space. I'm from Houston. Houston is obviously we have Johnson Space Center. We have enormous commercial space there. And you know, in the past several years, I've managed to pass two major pieces of legislation on space. One in 2015, the Commercial Space Launch Competitiveness Act. and then one in 2017, the NASA reauthorization, first NASA authorization in 7 years. The first bill was signed by President Obama. The second bill was signed by President Trump. You know, there are very few instances where you have a senator who's passed major substantive legislation with bipartisan agreement, one signed by Obama, one signed by Trump. I think that really underscores the deep bipartisan commitment there is to America's leadership in space and our continuing to move forward. The International Space Station, the American taxpayers have invested over $100 billion in developing the International Space Station. It is a priceless asset. I chaired a hearing yesterday on the International Space Station where we heard experts saying that it's scientifically, its useful life extends at least to 2028, if not 2030 or even later. And so the idea that we would, in 2025, essentially throw away an asset we've invested over $100 billion in, that's just foolishness.
Did running for president change you?
Oh, sure. Sure, it was an incredible experience. Heidi and I are deeply grateful for the opportunity to have run. It was the most impactful part of the presidential campaign was the unbelievable grassroots support we saw. We had nationally, we had 326,000 volunteers. All over the country, all over Texas, we would see people, ordinary people, truck drivers, school teachers, single moms, young people who would pour their heart into the campaign, who would give sacrificially of their time, of their energy, of their passion. They'd be on social media. They'd be giving $25 or $50 or whatever money they could afford. You know, this past weekend, I was meeting with grassroots activists in Texas who were out in the hot Texas sun knocking on doors. And it is both humbling and breathtaking to see the commitment so many Texans, so many Americans have to turning our country around, to fighting to preserve freedom, to preserve the American free enterprise system, but also to defend the Constitution, defend our liberties. And so both Heidi and I feel immensely grateful for the opportunity to have run for president and immensely grateful for all of the incredible men and women and young people that poured their heart and energy into that campaign and to the campaigns I've run in Texas for Senate.
Is there anything you would do differently next time?
When? You know, look.
There will be a next time?
Time will tell. We came very, very close the last time. We came within inches of winning, and ultimately we didn't prevail. And that at this point, I've run two elections in my life. The first one for Senate. You know, Senate was the first job I'd ever been elected to in my life. I joke the last thing I was elected to before the U.S. Senate was student council, and then the presidential race. Now, having run two races, I won one, I lost one. I can say unequivocally, winning is better than losing. But I'm grateful for the opportunity to do it, and life is long. We'll see what the future holds.
Senator Cruz, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Senator Ted Cruz. And now we turn to the Democratic nominee for Cruz's Senate seat, Congressman Beto O'Rourke. O'Rourke has represented Texas's 16th congressional district since 2013. And late last week, I spoke with the El Paso native in a park just outside his office on Capitol Hill. Congressman O'Rourke, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on.
You've said the U.S.-Mexico border has never been safer. What evidence do you have that that's true?
Well, the things that you can measure, you have the lowest levels of northbound apprehensions since 1971. You have the greatest deployment along the southern border. All in, we have just under 20,000 Border Patrol agents, most of them on the U.S.-Mexico border. We're spending close to $20 billion per year on border security, which in addition to those agents includes aerostat blimps, drones flying overhead, more than 600 miles of walls, fences, and physical barriers. And now you have the National Guard deployed. So whether it's the vigilance, the money that we spend, the low levels of northbound apprehensions, it has never been safer. And it does not mean that there are not legitimate threats and concerns that we have about illegal drugs that are crossed at the border, about humans who are smuggled at the border, and just the fact that we're a nation of laws and we need to know who is coming through. But it's important to see the border today in context. And by that context, it's never been more secure, more safe.
You've opposed the construction of a wall the entire length of the border. Is that because you don't think the wall will work to prevent unauthorized crossing and materials crossing the border that are illegal, or because you don't think those things are enough of a problem anymore?
I think the wall effectively pushes those who seek to come to this country to reunite with family, to work, in some cases who may very well pose a threat if they're trying to cross illegal drugs, into more dangerous terrain, increasing the likelihood of suffering and death. As you've seen total border crossings decrease, you've seen a fairly steady level of deaths of migrants, of laborers, of family members who are trying to cross. So for those who've studied it, it seems to have a negligible effect on total number of crossing attempts. It seems to increase the likelihood of death or suffering. And for all the cost, both in resources, in opportunity, and in taking U.S. property from U.S. property owners, because as you probably know, the wall is not built on the international boundary line, which is the Rio Grande River. It's built miles into the U.S. on private property. For all that cost, it's not having the intended effect, and it's just a real bad value for the U.S. taxpayer. There are much better ways to meet these challenges.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Are we spending too much on border security now?
I don't know that we're spending as effectively as we could be. John Cornyn, Republican senior senator of Texas, and I introduced legislation to focus on improving the safety and the efficacy of our border at our ports of entry. That's where around 99% of everyone and everything that comes into the United States crosses. So these are, in El Paso, the bridges over the Rio Grande that connect Ciudad Juarez and El Paso. 32 million lawful, legitimate crossings just last year between Ciudad Juarez and El Paso. $90 billion in U.S.-Mexico trade. Cornyn and I have decided that if we want to improve security, if we really want to know who and what is crossing into our border, let's beef up staffing at our ports of entry. And those are the customs officers, the women and men who wear the blue uniforms as opposed to the Border Patrol agents in the green, who facilitate legitimate trade and travel, stop those who are a threat to us, and give us a better understanding of who and what is coming in to the United States. So that's a way to facilitate more job growth, economic development, and enhance security. So I think there are smarter ways to do this, and those ideas cut across divisions of party and geography. Testament to that is Republican Senator John Cornyn and Democratic House Rep Beto O'Rourke introducing this legislation together.
Will that make it faster to get across that border headed northbound?
Yes, and you bring up a good point. There are people, U.S. citizens, constituents of mine, who may live in El Paso, pay taxes in El Paso, in Texas, in the U.S., work in Ciudad Juarez at a maquila or in some other position, and then as they cross back over that border to be with their families, to coach their kids' soccer game, they're waiting sometimes an hour to 3 hours in the worst-case scenarios because we don't have enough staff. We haven't invested enough in the technology, the infrastructure, and the facilities at those ports of entry, which economically speaking are absolute gold mines, and then as a fellow Paseño, have a fundamental impact on our quality of life and what it means to be the largest binational community in the Americas.
You propose legislation to allow U.S. veterans who have been deported to be naturalized overseas and therefore brought back into the country. That includes those who've been convicted of certain kinds of crimes. Help us understand that.
Yeah. So if you have volunteered, and today we are an all-volunteer armed forces, if you volunteered to put your life on the line and willingly go into danger at this country's direction to fight for the 99% of those in this country who today have not worn a uniform, who have not served in the armed services, I think you are owed a fast track to legal permanent residency, to citizenship, to your ability to more fully contribute to the success of this country, building upon your service so far. If you have been accused of a nonviolent drug crime, for example, I don't think that should prevent you from being able to be a success in El Paso, in Dallas, and Fort Worth, and McKinney, and anywhere that you want to live in Texas or the United States, owing from your service to this country. And the fact that we have deported veterans all over the world, many in Ciudad Juarez, whom we've gotten to know, who have made this sacrifice and yet are unable to enjoy what many of us would argue are the rights and responsibilities that they deserve following that sacrifice, that just doesn't make sense. And so Congressman Gonzalez and I have introduced this legislation to try to right that wrong.
You've been talking about changing federal drug laws for years now, including ending the federal prohibition on marijuana, maybe looking at other drug penalties. What do you say to communities affected by the opioid crisis?
Yeah, I think if we ended the prohibition on marijuana and effectively controlled its sale and distribution to keep it out of high schools, away from kids, and importantly, the profits away from cartels and criminals and kingpins, we would be better able to effectively meet the challenge of opioids and increasingly, as I travel Texas, methamphetamines that are affecting communities big and increasingly small, who right now don't have the resources to meet this public health challenge. And I think learning something from the war on drugs, and specifically the failed war on marijuana, which has led to the largest prison population on the planet, right here in the home of the brave, land of the free, the world's greatest democracy, a prison population disproportionately composed of people of color. Though Americans use illegal drugs at the same rate across race and ethnicity and country of national origin, I don't think that we're going to meet the challenge of opioid addiction and death and methamphetamine addiction and death by locking people up. I think we're going to do it by meeting it as a public health challenge, getting people treatment and care back on their feet so that they can work, pay taxes, finish their education, raise their kids, contribute to the success of their communities.
We're listening to my conversation with Congressman Beto O'Rourke. We'll continue after a short break. From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest today is Congressman Beto O'Rourke. I spoke with him late last week at a park outside his offices on Capitol Hill. Let's return to the conversation.
What's your take on the idea that President Trump might renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement as two separate bilateral deals, one with Canada, one with Mexico?
Listen, I want President Trump to be successful. No state has more to gain or more to lose on the future of NAFTA than does Texas. It's connected to, the Dallas Fed tells us, at least 1 million jobs in our state. One out of every four El Pasoans that I represent has a connection to the U.S.-Mexico trade relationship to thank for their job. So let's wish him every success in the world. I've had the ability to meet with his Commerce Secretary, with his U.S. Trade Representative, and here's the case that I've made. Whether you negotiate with Mexico and Canada unilaterally, whether these are comprehensive negotiations, whatever the outcome, NAFTA must remain intact. We have room for improvement in elevating the U.S. worker and her competitiveness, and I think a great opening opportunity is elevating the pay and conditions for the Mexican worker. If you're making $45 a week and you live in Ciudad Juarez, I can tell you that is not sustainable. You will not be able to put food on the table, a roof over your kid's head, and put anything aside for the future. When people in Juarez and throughout Mexico can organize the way that we can in the United States for better working conditions and wages, we are going to see wages go up in Mexico, which puts the U.S. worker at a greater competitive advantage. and ensures that we can compete for more of those factory jobs, more of those manufacturing jobs, more of those export jobs that we should rightly demand be created here in the U.S. So that's an opening in the negotiations. But to unilaterally withdraw from NAFTA, as the president has threatened, would devastate the American economy, would destroy a large part of the Texas economy, the farmers who depend on those markets, the suppliers who make the goods that find their way into the things that we manufacture together in Mexico, in the U.S., trading communities like McAllen and Brownsville, manufacturing hubs, the Toyota headquarters in North Texas. Wherever you look in Texas, we depend on that relationship. So let's strengthen it, not lose it.
You voted against the Farm Bill this year.
I did.
Why?
The Farm Bill punished those who do not have the means to provide for food on the table for their families, including, importantly, in rural farming communities where someone may not be able to find that job or that job training that would meet the draconian demands of that House Farm Bill. That Farm Bill, as you know, failed altogether in the House. It wasn't just my vote. It wasn't just the vote of Democrats. It was Republicans as well for different reasons. And hopefully what comes out of that is something that I've learned is a premium in this place. And that's consensus and compromise. And I'm willing to vote for something other than my ideal of perfection. But I need the majority to work in that same spirit as well.
You've talked about improving the Affordable Care Act. What doesn't work as well as it should right now?
Premiums are too high for those who are lucky enough to have health care at all, lucky enough to be insured. And all it is a matter of luck, of where you're lucky enough to work, the amount of money that you're lucky enough to have in your checking account, who you're lucky enough to be born to, the community that you're lucky enough to live in, because listening to those just outside of the Dallas-Fort Worth metro area, for example, in smaller, more rural counties, they may only have one or two insurance companies competing for their business. So they have seen premiums go through the roof to a degree that sometimes it's just not affordable anymore. And they're dropping out of these plans. At a minimum, I think we have to introduce Medicare as a competitor in those exchanges that are underserved today that will drive down price, increase competition, and improve selection for doctors and providers. We need to take the next step of expanding Medicaid in the state of Texas, one of the states that inexplicably, especially when the federal government was willing to pay 100 cents on the dollar for expansion, chose not to receive that help. Millions of our fellow Texans are out of the ability to see a doctor as a consequence. But I don't want to stop there, Chris. I think we have to have universal, high-quality, guaranteed health care for every child, woman, and man in the state of Texas. And if we fail to do that, not only will they be out the opportunity to lead their lives to their full potential, we, as our fellow Texans, as their fellow Texans, will lose out on everything that they're going to do in their lives, the education that they will complete, the jobs they'll work, the taxes they'll pay, the art that they will create, the families that they'll raise. We're losing out on all of that right now because in the least insured state in the country, that's what Texas is, we have too many people who are too sick to do what they and God intended for themselves in their lives. And though that's an expensive proposition, I'll admit that from the outset, it's a lot less expensive than what we're doing today. Because as you probably know, at some point or other, though you have not gone to a doctor in 20 years, at some point or other, you will be going to that doctor. And all of that deferred care for yourself, those preventative care appointments that you didn't receive, all of that will add up to a sum far greater than the cost of taking care of you up front in that emergency room visit, in your life cut short, in the catastrophic level of care that we're going to have to provide in a state whose largest provider of mental health care services today is the county jail system. So we can do better. We can do better at less expense, and we're going to see better output from our fellow Texans when we do.
Universal care sounds like single payer. Is single payer health care politically feasible in a country with such a deeply entrenched private health care delivery system?
Yes. The question could have been asked you know, 90 years ago is a system like Social Security, which will guarantee that every hardworking American does not live in poverty once they've retired from a life of work. Is that too big a hill for this country to climb? Or the same question could have been asked 60 years ago about Medicare. Can we ensure that every older American can get the health care that allows them to live well in their golden years after everything they've done to build up the success of this country? It's the same question that we're asking of ourselves today, and I think we have the same conclusion. It's not easy, but it's very necessary.
One of your campaign proposals is to empower the EPA to exercise oversight of those harming the environment, particularly drilling, fracking, and pipeline construction. That's a quote from your website. Does the EPA not have that power now?
I don't know that the EPA is effectively exercising its responsibility to protect the soil that we grow our food in, the air that we breathe, the water that we drink. I actually just had a meeting with members of the oil and gas industry last week and learned so much, as I do in any conversation that I have in Texas. It's just absolutely guaranteed. And so many of them have come to the table and have said, listen, we can do a lot when it comes to fugitive emissions of methane from these pipelines. It's literally a function of better sealing these joints and making sure that industry helps to lead and that there is oversight checking everyone, the big guys and gals for sure, but the smaller operations as well. And it's never, and it should never be a false choice for us. It's never a question of should we or should we not drill and transport oil and natural gas. Absolutely we should. The economy of this country and the world, our energy security and independence, jobs in Texas all depend on the ability to do that. But we can do it far more safely and effectively and I would argue profitably and with the public health in mind than we are doing today.
Some Texans who earn their livings from the oil and gas industry worry that additional expenses from additional environmental regulations will cost them their jobs.
I think that's a legitimate concern. I think there's always the risk that there will be over-regulation or that you'll create so much bureaucracy or that the road to job loss will be paved with good intentions from people who don't understand the work that these women and men do in Texas. And that's why I think there's a great opportunity and responsibility from those in the industry and those who understand it best to help lead the way. But the answer cannot be that jobs trump health or that we neglect our obligation to the generation that follows this one and the understanding that if this planet warms another 2 degrees Celsius, that we'll no longer be talking about storms ravaging Houston and 58 inches of rain being dumped on Southeast Texas. It'll be a question of can people any longer live in Houston and Port Arthur and Beaumont and Rockport and Port Aransas.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. In the March primary, Senator Cruz, who holds the seat that you are competing for, got twice as many votes as you. You won the primary, but he got twice as many votes. He got 300,000 more than you and your opponents combined. What kind of uphill battle is it to go into the general election with a deficit like that?
I tell you, I'm really encouraged by what we saw in the March primary. You saw a high watermark for Democratic midterm votes for a Senate candidate going back 36 years. You also, to your point, and to Ted Cruz's point, saw a high watermark for Republican midterm primary Senate votes. I think it may have been their all-time record. And that's a good thing. It's good for our democracy. It's good for a state that today ranks 49th in the country in voter turnout. Republican, Democrat, Independent, I'm just glad that you got after it, got out there and voted. But what I will also tell you is that when I go to communities like Paris or Cooper or Waxahachie or McKinney, I'm meeting people who tell me, Beto, I voted in the Republican primary because that's how I select my county commissioner, my justice of the peace, even the member of Congress who I think is going to be decided in that Republican primary. But I'm voting for you in November, because in the general election, given what's at stake right now about whether this is going to be a country of walls and Muslim bans and the press as the enemy of the people, with all of this at stake, I'm going to make sure that we make the right decision, and I will be voting for you. So I know that those Republican and independent voters, as well as those Democrats who I'm not going to take for granted, all need to be heard. I need to be out there listening to them and showing up and being in every single county. And I will this Saturday be in Gainesville, Texas, in Cook County, the 254th county, to listen to those, regardless of how reliably Republican that county is, because I know that they have a chance to help decide the future and the fate of this state and this country. And I'm going to be there to be with them.
Challenging Senator Cruz to two debates in Spanish, when it's common knowledge that he is not fully fluent in the Spanish language, what's that about?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't had the chance and don't want to assume anything about his proficiency in Spanish. I just know that...
I don't know that he hasn't claimed to be fluent in Spanish.
I don't know that. All I know is that as I travel the state, and it's not just in El Paso and Brownsville and McAllen and San Benito and Eagle Pass, it's in Dallas, it's in Henrietta, it's in Lubbock, Texas, that I meet our fellow Texans, our fellow U.S. citizens, who want to engage in Spanish as well as in English. And if I have any hope of effectively representing all 27, all 28 million of us in the state of Texas, I've got to be able to listen to and communicate with everyone, both in English and in Spanish. And so if we're going to have a debate on the issues, let's have that debate in English. Let's also have that debate in Spanish.
You've talked about term limits. If you don't win this Senate seat, where is your political career?
First of all, I think term limits are critically important if we're going to ensure that Congress reflects, literally looks like, the people that it intends to serve. And the reelection rate over the last 50 years is 93%. And so I want more and newer and more diverse voices and faces in the Senate and in the House. And the best way to ensure that is to limit the amount of time that I can serve, get me out of the way, and get someone who's going to do an even better job and bring their unique life experience and perspective to bear on the opportunities of this country. Should we not prevail in November, I'm going to continue to be the luckiest guy I've met and do a better job of raising my kids, Ulysses, Molly, and Henry, who are 11, 9, and 7, and contribute with everything that I have to my community of El Paso, and just continue to do everything within my power to lead the best possible life. And I have no idea where that will take me. But right now we're just, with everything we've got, focused on winning this election for all the people that we've met and will meet going forward. Everyone in Texas, Republican, Democrat, independent, non-voter alike, we're doing this for you.
Congressman O'Rourke, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you. Thanks for doing this.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. You can subscribe to the podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.